First case on our calendar is 982449, State of Ohio versus Ahmad Issa. Mr. Freeman.
May it please the court, counsel for the State of Ohio. Your Honor, this morning we will be emphasizing only the few of the multiple assignments of error. This case has been rather extensively briefed by both sides, but I don't mean to discount the importance of the other issues. I just want to focus us on the ones that I think involve some new law, since this case was ultimately heard on the facts, and also some equitable issues. Your Honor, at this point in time, I would like to talk about a certain aspects of hearsay in our second side of the error. In the state's response in their brief, they basically see this case as basically an evidence rule 801D2 matter. In rather simple fashion, say that an admission by a party opponent is not hearsay by definition unless it's admissible. We would respectfully say, Your Honor, that analysis needs to be made also of 804B3 and also of the Lilly case. I am, of course, referring to Lilly versus Virginia, which was decided on June 30th, I believe, of 1999, only a few short months after the Issa case was concluded by the trial court. Prior to that time, of course, the Gilliam case, decided by this court in 1994, was the law in Ohio. And under the previous law in Gilliam, a non-testifying accomplice's statement may be admitted as evidence of guilt, assuming it falls within a firmly rooted hearsay exception. We would respectfully submit, Your Honor, though, that the Lilly case, which came down, as I said before, only a few short months after the conclusion of Mr. Issa's trial in Hamilton County, first of all, it was a death penalty case. Secondly, it was a U.S. Supreme Court case. And thirdly, and most importantly, I think it's four square on point with this particular matter here. Essentially, we would respectfully submit that the Lilly case, in conjunction with your own court's findings since that time, the Lilly case adds a new ingredient to the hearsay analysis. It basically says that it's not good enough anymore just to define something by way of a co-conspirator's testimony as a hearsay exception. It throws in an extra requirement that certain indicia of reliability must in fact be affirmatively shown by the state of Ohio at the trial level. And if those adequate indicia of reliability are not shown, then the opposite result from Gilliam would be appropriate. We are confident, Your Honor, that on this particular issue, the change in the law that took place shortly after the conclusion of the Issa matter is applicable foursquare in this case, and therefore, the statements that Andre Miles made to the Mr. and Mrs. Willis, who had participated in the conspiracy to the limited extent they helped get rid of the weapon, that those statements must be excluded from consideration. Of course, they were admitted by the trial court, and we would respectfully submit that that is not harmless error. Conceitedly, Mr. Issa made a statement to law enforcement, which is a separate issue altogether, and there arguably is a basis for a conviction, notwithstanding the hypothetical exclusion of Mr. Riss's damaging situation on the hearsay matters. But what we are respectively suggesting, Your Honors, is that the damaging statements that Andre Miles was quoted as making to Mr. and Mrs. Willis, which talked about him being hired as a shooter by Mr. Issa in behalf of Mrs. Chris, the wife of the decedent, those statements respectively are extremely damaging to Mr. Issa.
But didn't the trial court admit those statements as under the hearsay exception for statements against interest?
Well, yes,
In Lilly and Madrigal, both of our case, Madrigal and Lilly, both involve statements made to the police.
I know there is a distinction there, Judge.
Yeah.
I respectfully submit there is an analogy that can be drawn.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand your point. Lilly has admissions made to law enforcement, whereas the other cases are are differentiated, that they are major co-conspirators and non-law enforcement people, but...
And maybe not the basic, the reason for finding them more reliable is they are not made, I mean, the difference between not making them to law enforcement and making them to a friend here, you can see that the foundation for the reliability seems quite different in the two.
Your Honor, I understand your argument, but with all due respect, I think we have weasels talking to weasels in this conversation about Mr. Biss's alleged involvement in this conspiracy. The Willises are people that I don't think you would trust with the money to plug your parking meter. The same way that would involve Mr. Andre Miles. Those circumstances were, I don't think we can just impute the liability to them on the sole predicate that law enforcement was not the recipient or the solicitor, if you will, of the state.
But it wouldn't be the sole, predicate, but it certainly would be a factor you were entitled to consider in looking at the liability overall. You would have somebody who just committed a crime, admitted he committed a crime, is explaining how he got there and why he got there, talking to somebody that he has nothing, he's not trying to exculpate himself, which is often what happens in a professional police where you throw blame on another party. I mean, when you look at all of the circumstances, not just the fact that it's not police, but it's a focus, well, they're not even co-conspirators, they had nothing to do with the crime, they're just people who display the nature of the crime too. How do you distinguish that?
Well, Judge, with all due respect, I do think they would be co-conspirators, arguably, to the limited extent that they were involved in the concealment and disposal of the AK-47 assault rifle after the shooting.
They didn't do anything other than actively not dispose of it. They didn't put it in their yard. They didn't hide it in their yard. They just found out it was in the yard and asked somebody to get rid of it from their yard.
Yes, ma'am, but they didn't report a crime, which I think would be a basis in favor of our position. They also gave specific instructions to Mr. Miles on several occasions as to how and where to dispose of the rifle, which several days later you correctly acknowledge that took place. I do remember in the transcript that they needed to be given immunity by the prosecution and law enforcement before they were willing to come in and testify at all, limited immunity for the testimony that they gave. But the fact that they were given immunity tells me that they arguably did something criminal, even though they never went to trial on that matter. But getting back to the original point, Your Honor, it is true that the totality of circumstances are a relevant factor in any situation.
Not according to the Supreme Court case, you can't argue me liable for anything to say.
Well, Judge, this area is a little bit in turmoil. Perhaps some people take a strict view of this. Some people take a little more extended view of this. I think there is a limited place for totality of circumstances, which was your point, but I think it's a small role relative to the overall suppression issue of hearsay matters.
The prosecution had admitted Miles' confession, or tried to admit Miles' confession, and or the trial court had admitted Miles' confession, wouldn't that directly set up the confrontation clause issue, as opposed to this being done through somebody else?
Probably that would be a better factual situation, Your Honor. I think that's what you're...
And didn't they decide not to do it just for that reason, not to admit it?
I believe so, but notwithstanding that, Your Honor, I think that this is, if you will, an end run around the same issue that at one point became defense-oriented and favorable. I think they tried to do indirectly here with what they couldn't do directly with the actual confession of Mr. Andre Miles, the shooter. I see your point that it's inconsistent on its face with the other situation, but it wouldn't be the first time that a party in any piece of complicated litigation tries to prove the same fact through a different mechanism.
I didn't see in any agreement that no motive was not necessary for conviction, but what was the state's theory of why it so would want these two parties killed? I couldn't figure that out.
Factually, Your Honor, Mrs. Chris was the wife at the time of the deceit. There were actually two people who were shot, but only one was charged in this indictment. There was only one homicide set out in the indictment. That was the homicide of her husband at the time. Factually, what happened, Judge, Mrs. Chris had learned that her husband was planning to divorce her, which would arguably create a financial hardship to her. And the state's theory on all three cases, and they were tried in the sequence of Mrs. Chris, Senator Miles, and then Mr. Issa, was that Mrs. Chris, because of the divorce reason, approached Mr. Issa, who was of similar national origin, and basically confided in him that it would be a good idea, assuming he was willing, if he could find someone to knock off her husband. Mr. Issa then allegedly did exactly that. He came up with the name of a customer of the convenience store, one of the convenience stores that this couple owned, as a potential sleazy character who might be going to do it. That would be Andre Miles. At that point in time, Mr. Issa allegedly approached Andre Miles and basically offered to pay him a certain amount of money to perform a hit, which...
Andre Miles, was your Canadian office?
No, Andre Miles is an African-American citizen of the United States.
And Mrs. Chris was found not guilty.
Mrs. Chris was found not guilty in the first trial.
Jordan, and she's found guilty. Didn't she then go back home, if you will, to, what was it, Jordan or Lebanon? Has she ever been heard or seen since?
Judge, that is a very excellent question. I wish I knew the answer to that. There is a theory that she may not even be allowed to go back to Jordan right now.
All right, that's enough. Thanks. I understand.
Your Honors, I want to talk about one more issue, and this is almost...
Miles got another one.
This is basically the issue of the variances in sentences. And as I alluded to earlier, we had three parties, all of whom were charged in separate trials with the same identical homicide. Now, I know what you're thinking. There is no exact peg out here to hang my hat on. But I would respectfully submit, ladies and gentlemen, that if this were a civil case, I'd be asking you to put on your equitable hat and basically try and fix what's wrong here. Mrs. Chris, who arguably is the most involved of the group, was acquitted for one reason or another, and we have no transcript because there was no conviction and therefore no appeal, so I have no record, of course, to present to you as to exactly what happened. But my understanding, basically, is that the jury was confused about the instructions and came up with a result, hindsight-wise, that was inappropriate for that reason.
But the trigger man was Miles.
The trigger man was Andre Miles.
He actually did the killing.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's only one here. And he was given life in prison.
He was given life in prison.
Now, I looked specifically to find why that might have been, and the explanation isn't as clear to me as I would like. Why would, if you will, a co-conspirator get the death penalty and the actual trigger man get life in prison?
This is exactly
in your judgment.
Judge, I know enough about the Andre Miles case to know that his mother came to court and was rather eloquent talking about his background and physical abuse, mental abuse, things like that, some sexual problems, I believe. But in my humble estimate, it was his mother who was the person that saved his life by her pleading to the jury to consider the circumstances under which he was raised without father and under certain abusive conditions, stepfathers, things like that. But the very existence of your question, Your Honor, by you tells me that you're having trouble with the same issue that I'm having trouble with. I think all of us, at least I hope all of us, originally when we became lawyers, did that not just to get rich and become important, but also to try and fix what's wrong. And it just seems to me that there is a certain inequity here that the person, Mr. Issa, who was only the equivalent of the real, bringing one person and the other person together.
Well, the jury could have looked at that as the reason to give him the death penalty because he was seeking someone to commit murder for a price. And it would depend on how the jury looked at that. They could determine that was more serious than just using this other man, Miles, as the trigger man.
Your Honor, I would prefer to analyze this trifurcated matter as being three people equally seriously involved in different capacities. That's some of the concession from some of my associates' analysis, but I'm just trying to put this forward, if you will, most favorably to the state of Ohio. But let's assume for the sake of argument that the person who had the idea and paid the money is as guilty as the middle person, Mr. Issa, and they're both as guilty as the shooter, Andre Miles. We still are left with the inequities of one person, for whatever reason, getting out of the fix altogether. And Mrs. Crist did not testify. There's never been any testimony anywhere in any courtroom that she didn't do it. Namely, pay money to Mr. Issa.
But she was found not guilty, so it's entirely considered the case.
It's just that I think that when all of us go into a courtroom anywhere, we have a reasonable expectation, not to mathematical certainty of results, but to some equitable sense of fairness as to what happens. In my humble opinion, you almost need to get to this level of appeal before...
Well, counsel, there's two opportunities before you get here. What you're suggesting is this ought to be leveled off because of the result of the first two.
Exactly, Your
Honor. The first opportunity is the prosecutor to number life with that possibility of parole. Was that offered?
No, Your Honor, there was no offer involved here.
The defendant
defendant, my understanding is actively sought that, but there was, my distinct recollection was there was no life offer as to Mr. Issa.
Did the defendant indicate his willingness to plead?
I've been up to see him at Mansfield, and his recollection of what happened in the trial with different counsel is that he
was... Anything in the record on that?
Not in the record, Judge, unfortunately.
Second opportunity is the trial judge who presumably knows the outcome of the first two cases.
Yes, Your Honor. But this is, with all due respect, the Hamilton County case.
Was there a forceful argument to the trial judge to not grant the death sentence to... the trial judge does have that authority, doesn't
he? Yes, he does, Your Honor. And there was an argument made to him, but... I don't want to say half-hearted, I just want to say that they raised the issue, but...
The issue you're raising now, not... I mean, there could be plenty of different arguments as to why that would be not death. Was the specific argument that you're presenting to us advanced to the trial court?
I believe it was incorporated in the Rule 29 motion, which got renewed at various stages of the trial. I just, from a realistic standpoint, would ask you to look at the politics of doing the right thing at the state court level. And I have a lot of respect for the trial judge. It's just that it's a tough call to circumvent a jury's recommendation of death.
You're going to get any easier because it's here.
Well, Judge, it's tough every place, but I think that, for better or worse, this court has the assignment of partially looking over the shoulder of other courts to make sure that the right thing happens, sir. Keep in mind, we're not asking that Mr. Issa be, when we raise this argument, totally left out of participation in punishment that would be appropriate. This argument separates itself from the other arguments to the extent that we are now conceding he did it, if you will, just in this argument. But what we're saying is, level the playing field, given the overall equities, or inequities, if you will, between himself, between Mr. Miles, and between Mrs. Chris, all of whom got radically different results on essentially the same set of facts.
But without the activities of FISA, there would have been no murder.
Your Honor, it is true that he brought the money and the idea person together with the shooter, and they never would have connected up without him. Sure.
It was his idea. He furnished all the equipment necessary. He drove them to the assigned place. Everything without his activity, I could see a jury weighing all that and seeing that without this is initial involvement in this whole thing, this man would still be allowed.
Of course, Your Honor, I'm not sure how much discretion a jury is allowed to hear about other pending cases of the same event.
But the court relied upon that and stated exactly what Justice Sweeney has stated, that but for his participation, the crime would not have occurred, since he supplied the trigger man with the means to carry out the homicide, paid him money, and so that was one of the factors that the court relied on heavily in affirming the jury's finding of the death penalty.
You are accurate, Judge. The only thing I would present by way of a rebuttal position is that you could apply a but-for argument to both Mrs. Chris and Andre Miles, because without the money and the idea, neither of the other two would have gotten involved, and with just the money and the idea and a search of flour.
Mrs. Chris was acquitted.
Yes, she was.
Can I turn your attention to the absolute matter?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any evidence in the record that anyone ever informed the defense of his right?
I don't remember in the record seeing a reference to it.
I wasn't clear whether he was informed and chose not to exercise it, or whether he was never actually informed.
Well, Your Honor, you're asking me if it's proof of a non-fact. I don't remember seeing it. Frankly, I was not prepared to argue that particular assignment today. I do remember Professor Rice's argument from Gonzaga, the separate brief that he filed with Mikas in this matter. My personal recollection is that I don't recall, but I cannot, to a mathematical certainty, stand behind that answer.
Would there be a difference in that position if you were advised and chose not to exercise it? Because you can't force the person to go to the council.
Certainly, Your Honor. I would agree with the premise that this is what you're saying, that had Mr. Gissel been advised, he could have given up his right to see a representative of his own government to join any government. I think it would be just like the Moran situation. I don't think the law requires that you have a lawyer. I think the law requires that you have the opportunity to have a lawyer, a right which you can, assuming it's knowing and intelligently given up, walk away from if you think that's the better way to proceed.
Do you agree that Article 36 does not require, doesn't place any burden on the arresting authorities to advise the person arrested of the consular agreement?
I agree to a limited extent, Your Honor, that Article 36 does not specifically spell that out. But I think there's a common sense, just as all of us in Ohio are required to know the law, whether we subjectively know the law or not, I think that it's, you have to work on the theory that an international treaty is out there and it is the law.
Well, there's a lot of law that I guess arresting officers could advise, which arresting officers could advise somebody's been arrested, but we don't place, except for Miranda, we don't place burdens on them to do that, do we?
No, Your Honor. But with all due respect, I think that when you're talking about a Jordanian national, it's reasonable to assume that his linguistic abilities are somewhat limited. It's reasonable to assume that his level of trust is somewhat limited. I think, in my own humble opinion, that a person of his native origin in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he has, I assume, a very small support group, arguably would have needed a representative from the consulate more than a lawyer at the first stage, because the lawyer would be seen perhaps as just another member of a system that he doesn't understand, whereas the consular person would have linguistic skills and the ability to create the trust relationship.
We would have to deem that a constitutional right, I guess, wouldn't we, which hasn't been done yet by the U.S. Supreme Court. Would, I mean, to get where you want us to be, don't we have, because the agreement doesn't say that, and so we have to create a constitutional right, don't we?
Well, I certainly couldn't find a case to support it, Judge, but that doesn't mean this couldn't be a good place to start. This has been an issue that's been waltzed around by courts from one end of the country to the other, and then sometimes it gets procedurally defaulted, so that it just seems that there's a big brush not to deal with this particular point at any substantive level. I can't find authority for it, that's what you're asking about, the constitutional aspect.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Springman.
May it please the court, Mr. Freeman. The state position, at least on the hearsay, is we're under the belief that we were a little bit concerned about the Gilliam and the analysis under Gilliam, whether or not it was going to hold up as law. So in looking at what we had, the evidence we had in this case, we thought we would proceed, and we are on excellent legal grounds to proceed under Evidence Rule 801D2E, and getting the Willis statements admitted through the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule.
Mr. Spring, before you get into detail on those two issues that he discussed, I was just curious about one thing here, and that I wondered why there wasn't more made of it. Now, I understand it isn't necessarily pertinent to Mr. Issa and the conviction and death sentence that he has, but there were two murders here,
right.
Brothers.
Right.
And the only one he was charged with is, he was only charged with one of the two.
Right.
And there seems to be little or no discussion about the brother who was killed at the same time.
Right.
Was that because he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and there was no real motive or anything else for that?
I think so, Judge, because I know that there was some evidence that Linda Chris agreed to throw in some bonus money, $1,500, because Andre Miles had a killer brother. But I think it was a little bit more tenuous, at least for us, to try to connect Ahmad Issa with the death of the brother. We could clearly connect it with the death of Merrick Chris because that was a conspiracy that took place with plenty of reflection over time, and we felt that that was the best way to proceed in this matter, and that's why we did so.
I wondered why, because they were obviously killed both at the same time at the same place.
Right, and I think he just didn't get in the way. I don't think the conspirators expected that to happen when they were thinking about killing Merrick Chris. In fact, the original plan called for Merrick Chris, to be executed in front of the Chris residence. And they abandoned that because they thought that might be a little too risky, too public. So they decided to do it late at night at the Safeway convenience store where they could easily lure him there. So that's what happened here. Again, you know, our position, we just wanted to be on more solid legal ground, and that's why we proceeded under 801D2E, because we had all the foundation requirements that are under State versus Daniels for the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. In fact, in the trial below,
I'm still struggling with how you get them into co-conspirator. I mean, I can see you saying that they covered up a crime or they failed to record a crime, but what evidence do you have that they planned or participated or assisted in it?
Well, we have that through Andre Miles, and it's my impression of the law that we have to establish first the existence of a conspiracy, and then that the declarant, which is Andre Miles, participated in it, and then that the defendant, Ahmad Issa, participated in it. And then we have to get to the third and fourth foundational requirements, that they were in furtherance of the conspiracy, the statements were made in furtherance of the conspiracy, and in the course of the conspiracy. And
your co-conspirator really goes to Miles' statement, not to the two that are relaying the hearsay.
Right.
You're not saying the two that relayed the hearsay are co-conspirators.
Exactly. That's correct, Your Honor. Right. Exactly. And, you know, defense counsel, when we don't necessarily have to do this, but I think the trial court wanted us to establish a foundation prior to the statements coming in before the jury. So we had Bonnie Willis testify outside the presence of the jury, and she laid most of the foundation for the co-conspirator exception rule, or the requirements under Daniels. And in laying out that testimony, you know, defense counsel agreed that we showed a conspiracy, that the defendant participated in it, and that Miles, the declarant, participated in it. Their only argument that they made to the trial court below is that they thought the statements were made after the deaths of the two victims, and therefore they were not made in furtherance or in the course of the conspiracy. But really, case law directly refutes that. And we cited, I think, State versus Durr, which relies on State versus Shelton, that a conspiracy to commit a crime doesn't necessarily end with the commission of the crime. And then it goes on to say in the law is that as long as the conspirators are trying to conceal their identity or they're still on the loose, they're still on the lam, then the statements are made in the course of the conspiracy or in furtherance of the conspiracy. And here, when Miles made the statement to the Willises, the gun had not yet been recovered. And he talked to the Willises about what happened because he was concerned that they had some information and would go to the police. So after he was finished telling the Willises what happened, he threatened them. He says, if you tell anybody what happened, I am going to kill you. So clearly, these statements were made in the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. And they fit squarely under, you know, Evidence Rule 801 D2E. That's our position, including the statements about the gun. That's been our position at trial and still our position on appeal, even though the judge let the statements about the gun in under Evidence Rule 804 be free of statement against interest. Having addressed that, I'll address the inequity argument that has been made by defense counsel. And to me, it looks like our position would be that the system really here is working. Linda Chris was acquitted, and none of that evidence is before the court. But then we have Andre Miles, who's convicted. He was charged. And our position, by the way, has been consistent throughout this. We charged Linda Chris, Andre Miles, and Ahmad Issa with death-eligible aggravated murder. We refused any plea bargains along the way. We believed we had enough evidence to convict. We were wrong about Linda Chris. But we went forward. And then Andre Miles, as is required under the death penalty law, has the right to his mitigation defense, which, again, is not before the court. But according to Mr. Freeman, he did put forth a very substantial amount of mitigation and convinced the jury that he should be spared the death penalty. Here in this case, I would submit that the reason Ahmad Issa received the death penalty is because he was not able to put forth a strong mitigation defense. Again, through no fault of defense counsel, it just didn't exist. I can, in 5 minutes, outline what his mitigation is. Mr. Issa was the fifth of seven children. Three of the children were able to obtain a college education. I think Mr. Issa, Ahmad Issa here, he'd been in the United States for the last 8 years. His degree was a two-year college degree in, I think it's construction engineering. I know the transcript at some point is called commercial engineering. I think that's just a misprint. But he studied in Jordan at a college called Zarqa National College. He assisted his family. He did send some money home. His father also, the testimony from Mr. Issa's brother, was that the father assisted the family and the members in obtaining an education. The defendant also received a certificate of good behavior while in school, and he had a pretty good relationship with his nephews. And he had ambitions of getting married and having a family. Mr. Issa's mother also testified during mitigation, and she said that his father had high hopes for the children, that the Barrett family was very happy, very close-knit when he was home, and that the family, even after her husband died, was able to maintain a very good standard of living.
Counsel, how many of our 100-plus death row inmates whose cases have gone through appeals to this court, the first level, first round of appeals, are not personally to actually committed murder
decision.
We're not physically involved in any criminal jurisdiction.
I'll admit I didn't do a statistical analysis of that. I would imagine that those fact patterns did not present themselves that often. Number one, there's proof difficulties. And number two, they might not be as cold or as callous as this, because this crime, really, when one thinks about the reflections that went on between Linda Chris and the defendant.
I think we have someone from the Lucasville Lodge who's in that situation, but that would be discernibly different, would it not?
Probably not. I'm not. I wasn't involved in the Youngest Bill Ryan case, so I'm not familiar with the specific facts, but there probably were some that my understanding did not get the death penalty. But then there's State versus Robb. I think Robb was a pretty good case and actually involved the same issues we're here today, the co-conspirator accepted the hearsay rule. And he was a co-conspirator and received the death penalty. So that's one case I'm familiar with.
Do you know whether the defendant
either advised counsel? Judge, it's not in the record. I searched for it because that issue was new to me when I first read it, and I was a little bit concerned about it. And there's not a whole lot of law, at least locally, on it. I looked at the case that I cited before. This is for Greer versus Green. And, you know, I would be more concerned about it if it were in the record that he was informed of his right to consult with counsel. But procedurally, you know, he could have been. We just don't know. It's just not part of the record. But the question becomes, and as one court noted, where's the prejudice? You know, Mr. Issa had been in the United States for 8 years, and there could be prejudice. I'm not saying someone from outside this country is certainly very unfamiliar with the legal system in the United States. But then the other argument is, if they're unfamiliar with it, the best way to become familiar with it is hire a lawyer from the county where the crime was committed that understands the local legal culture.
I read the cases about no prejudice. I understand that argument.
Right.
But I grew up in a foreign country, and I sure buy the argument that if we don't enforce the treaty here, how can we ever expect a country to enforce the treaty when our American citizens are? I mean, that's a policy argument, perhaps, that we need to look at. But it's a darn serious one. We have Americans abroad arrested all the time, and how can we judge what prejudice was to that person in their system? Without our consulate sitting by their side watching the proceedings, because they all have very different systems, and there's a heck of a lot of foreign citizens in the market. And the market is a disparity between blacks and other nationals.
Right.
So, how can we expect other countries to get ever divide people with the same rights if we don't honor the treaty as their rights and don't hide behind a cloak of state, no prejudice?
Right. Judge, you make a good point. I really wouldn't know how to respond other than probably that is a problem, I would agree. Now, legally, I'm not so sure that it would be the burden on this court to write that into the law. Perhaps some kind of Congress.
That law has to be clear somewhere, doesn't it? I mean,
somewhere, right.
Our court says you either do or you don't honor the treaty, and maybe this is the place to start it, and then somebody take it up and test it.
Yeah. And the only thing is, I think that there has to be a situation where it's probably part of this educating law enforcement. They have to be aware that this treaty exists, and they have to be aware that when they arrest a foreign national, that they have to advise them of the right to see the consulate. You know, my guess is, just my only guess is that they're just simply not aware of it, and it doesn't dawn on them that that's an extra added step that they need to make when they arrest a foreign national. And you know, it would have been nice if they would have done that here, I agree. Whether it would have made a difference or not, I would think not here. But, it's not a constitutional right yet. It hasn't been written in yet. But I do think the points are well taken. You know, I don't know.
So where does it say that we don't have to have a constitutional right?
Well, it doesn't say that. It's just it's not a constitutional right. The police officers have to inform someone of the right to consult the consulate.
But is it the law?
Well, it's a treaty, so.
Is the treaty a law?
Yes.
And of course the law?
I believe it, yes, well.
The Constitution says it has to be.
Kind of right.
So maybe therefore it is a constitutional right if the Constitution says it has to be.
Right. It's just procedurally, I have problems with, you know, I'm sure the police weren't aware of it. It hasn't really been enforcement of a case. There really hasn't been a whole lot of guidance to us on this.
Don't be always telling defendants the ignorance of the law, you know.
True, we do. It is an excuse. But at the same time, you know, we don't know if he was denied that right here. It's just not in the record. We just don't know that. There's just not
Mr. Freeman, let me ask you, do you... Mr. Freeman answered my question on this issue, I think agreed with me that the treaty does not require an arresting authority, at least in 36 it doesn't. I don't have the full treaty before me, but it doesn't require, there's no express requirement that the arresting authority advise a foreign person that there is a treaty. That,
right, no.
So where is the duty then? The duty is, if the foreign person says, I want to talk to my counselor office, then there's a duty to let them do it, isn't there?
That's my understanding, Judge. Yeah. Okay. Yes, that's my understanding of it. And
would your understanding also be that Bonnie's testimony, to go back to the other issue, that Bonnie's testimony was indispensable to this conviction?
Well,
pretty important.
Certainly important.
Okay. And you held a hearing, as I understand what you said. I thought you said a Davis hearing. You must mean the Judge Davis.
Judge Davis.
Okay. Okay. I was looking, I thought, I don't remember a Davis
Did
case.
I say that?
Okay. No, I just missed it maybe. But in any event, you held a separate hearing outside of the presence of the jury,
right,
to establish whether or not Bonnie's testimony was admissible?
And Josh's testimony. I think,
yeah,
that
well, I just want to stick with Bonnie for a minute.
Okay.
Okay, you did that?
Yes.
Why'd you do that?
I think the judge wanted us to do that, to be perfectly honest. It's not in the record.
So there was some real reservation about admitting these statements that were made to his, quote, friends, because of the hearsay question.
Well, yes, but we switched legal theories.
That's where I'm getting lost.
Right. We were proceeding under a Gilliam analysis, and our trial counsel was proceeding under a Gilliam analysis. They consulted health division, specifically Mr. Breyer, and then we went over the evidence again, and Mr. Breyer then argued before the Judge Davis and said that we should try to get these statements in under evidence rule 801D2E.
Okay, now let's establish, what is a Gilliam analysis?
Well, the Gilliam, I think, is the case where we had the co-conspirator, where you had a statement against interest by one co-conspirator, and the other conspirator took the Fifth Amendment, was unavailable to testify.
That was clearly a Fifth Amendment case, wasn't
it? Right, clearly. Yeah.
And here, they just declared somebody to be unavailable because he wouldn't say anything.
Right. There's no requirements for unavailability under the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. I call an exception.
So you went partway through on a Gilliam theory, and then the appellate division determined that was faulty, and for what reason?
Well, we didn't determine it was faulty. We decided we would be on more solid legal ground if we went under the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. There was a little bit of concern about, with some of the pronouncements from this court about Gilliam, and we just thought it would be better, and we certainly have the foundational requirements necessary for the co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. That seemed to be the best legal avenue, the more solid legal avenue to admit those statements.
Because in fact, that these were statements against interest by ISO and had high degree of trustworthiness?
Oh, certainly. They did. I think they do. I mean, when Miles made these statements, I think, why would somebody admit to these murders, the details, tell people not to tell or I'll kill you, and so forth. And then we had independent evidence of conspiracy, too. Like, we had Esau, assisting in getting rid of the gun out of the Willis' backyard. We had some other testimony, some foundation testimony that he said Miles had, right before the killings, they've been talking unusual together and so forth.
But that all comes from the Willises.
No, that doesn't. That comes from an employee of the
gun. The gun in the backyard? That was the Willises.
Yes, that comes from the Willises. And then the defendant acknowledged, Issa acknowledged that who else knows? He didn't say, what gun, what are you talking about? When the Willises approached him, he said, who else knows? Well, the gun was still not removed. The Willises see a white bag in their backyard and are aware that the gun is concealed in a white bag and are concerned about the safety of children. Both Josh and Bonnie approach the defendant and say, you've got to get that gun out of the backyard. And the defendant says, if Miles does it, or Dre, referring to Andre Miles, doesn't do it, I will. clearly acknowledging that he knew the existence of the gun in Willis's backyard. Plus, of course, there were 7.62 caliber bullets found next to the door of the defendant's residence.
That was also an interesting fact for me. They had trouble matching those shell casings up, didn't they?
I thought they didn't have any trouble determining that the caliber of bullet found in the defendant's nightstand drawer matched the caliber of the weapon that was actually fired.
Yeah, but the ones at the scene.
Yeah, well,
the casings, they couldn't trace those to that gun, could they?
Yeah, there were some that they couldn't trace, I thought, because there might have been another gun that Miles might have used, some theory about that. But overall, there was still, we had a pretty good foundation framework for the 801D testimony. But again, unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Springman. Mr. Freeman, you've saved 5 minutes of your time.
Your Honor, I will be very brief. I do think this is not properly analytically approached. Here's the issue that is it in what manner? I think this is a 804B3 matter. I think the trial court was correct in the 804B3 analysis, and the only reason they came to a different bottom line was the simple circumstance that the law was different at the exact day and time when that decision from an evidentiary standpoint was made, and that was because Gilley against the law. Now that we have the Lilly case in place, as well as your own interpretation of and ramification of it in the Mandrigal manner, I think the result would have been different, and this court can correct that mistake. I don't think the mistake is any reflection on the trial judge, given the status of the law at the time, but the point is the U.S. Supreme Court as well as this court have both respectively come up with a different result. Furthermore, I do not think it's harmless there because the statements that were here say were critical to this conviction. True, there was some evidence by some other people of Mr. Diss's involvement, but the thing that broke the camel's back, so to speak, was the very damaging testimony of Bonnie Willis, which was allowed into evidence over defense objection. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.